secure to the spell in the north, beyond the Manadal stairs, was read in the stars by a slightly crazy astrologer by the name of Zathisius. Later, when I was emperor, I gave him a tower and apparatus for that. At that time, he had to work on borrowed equipment. You know, it's a waste of time getting bogged down in what happened in Sintra. I deny, however, that it supposedly had anything to do with Vilgefortz. Firstly, I didn't know him then, and secondly, I had a strong aversion to mages. Even today, I don't like them, actually. Ah, while I remember, when I regained the throne, I caught up with a sorcerer who had served the usurper and tortured me in front of my father's eyes. I also displayed a sense of humor. The mage's name was Briathins, and in our language, that sounds almost the same as fried. Enough digressions, though. Let's get back to the matter at hand. Vilgefortz visited me secretly in Sintra, shortly after Ciri's birth. He passed himself off as a trusted friend of people in Nilfgaard who were still loyal to me and had conspired against the usurper. He offered help and soon proved to be capable of helping. When, still mistrustful, I asked about his motives, he bluntly declared he was counting on gratitude for the favors, privileges, and power he would be given by the great emperor of Nilfgaard, meaning me. A powerful ruler who would govern half the world, who would beget an heir who would govern half the world. He intended to rise high himself, or so he declared, without inhibition, at the side of those great rulers. Here, he took out some scrolls bound with snakeskin and commended the contents to my attention. Thus, I learned of the prophecy. I learned about the fate of the world and the universe. I found out what I had to do, and came to the conclusion that the end justifies the means. Of course. My affairs were prospering in Nilfgaard, meanwhile. Emir ignored the sarcasm. My partisans were gaining more and more influence. Finally, having a group of frontline officers and a corps of cadets, they decided to launch a coup d'etat. I was needed for that, nonetheless. Me, myself, the rightful heir to the throne and crown of the empire, a rightful Emrys with the blood of the Emryses. It was to be something akin to the standard of the revolution. Just between us, plenty of the revolutionaries cherished the hope that I would be nothing more than that. Those among them who are still alive cannot get over it to this day. But, as has been said before, let us leave the digressions. I had to return home. The time came for Duni, the false prince of Mecht and the phony duke of Sintra, to demand his inheritance. I hadn't forgotten about the prophecy, however. I had to return with Ciri, and Calanthe was keeping a weather eye on me. She never trusted you. I know. I think she knew something about that prediction, and would have done anything to hamper me, and in Sintra, I was in her power. It was clear I had to return to Nilfgaard, but in a way that no one could guess that I was Duni and Ciri was my daughter. Vilgefortz suggested a way. Duni, Pavetta, and their child had to die, vanish without trace. In a staged shipwreck. That's right. During the voyage from Skellige to Sintra, Vilgefortz was to pull the ship into a magical whirlpool over the Sedna Abyss. Pavetta, Ciri, and I were supposed to have previously locked ourselves in a specially secured lifeboat and survive, and the crew were meant not to survive, finished the Witcher. And that's how your ruthless path began. Emir Var Emrys said nothing for some time. It began earlier, he finally said, and his voice was soft. Regrettably. At the moment, it turned out Ciri wasn't on board. Geralt raised his eyebrows. Unfortunately, I hadn't appreciated Pavetta in my planning. The Emperor's face didn't express anything. That melancholy wench with her permanently lowered eyes had seen through me and my plans. She had sent the child ashore in secret before the anchor was weighed. I fell into a fury, as she did. She had an attack of hysteria. During the struggle, she fell overboard. Before I could dive after her, Vilgefortz had drawn the ship into his maelstrom. I hit my head against something and lost consciousness. I survived by a miracle, entangled in the ropes. I came to, covered in bandages. I had a broken arm. I wonder how a man feels after murdering his wife, the witcher said coldly. Lousy, replied Emir without delay. I felt, and I feel lousy and bloody shabby. Even the fact that I never loved her doesn't change that. The end justifies the means. Yet I sincerely do regret her death. I didn't want it or plan it. Pavetta died by accident. You're lying, Geralt said dryly. And that doesn't befit an emperor. Pavetta could not live. She had unmasked you and would never have let you do what you wanted to do to Ciri. She would have lived, Emir retorted. Somewhere. Far away. There are enough castles. Dun Rowan, for instance. I couldn't have killed her. Even for an end that was justified by the means. One can always find a less drastic means. The Emperor wiped his face. There are always plenty of them. Not always, said the Witcher, looking him in the eyes. Emir avoided his gaze. That's exactly what I thought, Geralt said, nodding. Finish your story. Time's passing. Calanthe guarded little Ciri like the apple of her eye. I couldn't even have dreamed of kidnapping her. My relations with Vilgefortz had cooled considerably, and I still had the dislike of other mages. But my military men and aristocracy were urging me hard towards war, towards an attack on Sintra. They vouched that the people were demanding it, that the people wanted living space, that listening to the Vox Populi would be a kind of imperial test. I decided to kill two birds with one stone, by capturing both Sintra and Ciri in one go. You know the rest.
I do,
Geralt nodded.
Thank you for the conversation, Dooney. I'm grateful that you are willing to devote your time to me. But I cannot delay any longer. I am very tired. I watched the death of my friends who followed me here to the end of the world. They came to rescue your daughter, not even knowing her. Apart from Kair, none of them even knew Ciri. But they came here to rescue her, for there was something in her that was decent and noble. And what happened? They found death. I consider that unjust, and if anyone wants to know, I don't agree with it. Because a story where the decent ones die and the scoundrels live and carry on doing what they want is full of shit. I don't have any more strength, Emperor. Summon your men. Witcher, the secret has to die with those who know it. You said it yourself. You don't have a choice. It's not true that you have plenty of them. I'll escape from any prison. I'll take Ciri from you. There's no price I wouldn't pay to take her away, as you well know.
I do.
You can let Yennefer live. She doesn't know the secret.
She would pay any price to rescue Ciri, Emir said gravely, and avenge your death.
True.
The Witcher nodded.
Indeed. I'd forgotten how much she loves Ciri.
You're right, Dooney.
Well, you can't run from destiny.
I have a request.
Yes?
Let me say goodbye to them both. Then I'll be at your disposal.
Emir stood by the window, staring at the mountain peaks.
I cannot decline you, but don't worry. I won't tell Ciri anything. I'd be harming her by telling her who you are. And I couldn't harm her.
Emir said nothing for a long time, still turned towards the window.
Perhaps I do have a debt to you.
He turned on his heel.
So hear what I will offer you in payment. Long, long ago, in former times, when people still had honour, pride and dignity, when they valued their word and were only afraid of shame, it happened that persons of honour, when sentenced to death and to escape the shameful hand of the executioner, would enter a bath of hot water and open their veins. Is it possible?
Order the bath filled.
Is it possible, the Emperor calmly continued, that Yennefer might wish to accompany you in that bath?
I'm almost certain of it. But you must ask. She has quite a rebellious nature.
I know.
Yennefer agreed at once.
The circle is closed,
she added, looking down at her wrists.
The serpent Ouroboros has sunk its teeth into its own tail.
I don't understand, Ciri hissed like an infuriated cat. I don't understand why I have to go with him. Where to? What for?
Daughter,
Yennefer said softly.
This and no other is your destiny. Understand that it simply can't be otherwise.
And you?
Our destiny awaits us.
Yennefer looked at Geralt.
This is the way it has to be. Come here, my daughter. Hug me tightly.
They want to murder you, don't they? I don't agree. I've only just got you back. It's not fair.
He who lives by the sword,
Emiavar Emrys said softly, dies by the sword. They fought against me and lost, but they lost with dignity. Ciri was standing before him in three strides, and Geralt silently sucked in air. He heard Yennefer's gasp.
Damn it, he thought. Everybody can see it. All his black-uniformed army can see what can't be hidden. The same posture, the same sparkling eyes, the same grimace. Arms crossed on the chest identically. Fortunately, extremely fortunately, she inherited her ashen hair from her mother. But anyhow, when you scrutinize them, it's clear whose blood...
But you won,
said Ciri, glaring at him passionately.
You won! And do you think it was with dignity?
Emiavar Emrys didn't reply. He just smiled, eyeing the girl with a clearly contented gaze. Ciri clenched her teeth.
So many have died. So many people have died because of all this. Did they lose with dignity? Is death dignified? Only a beast could think like that. Though I looked on death from close up, it wasn't possible to turn me into a beast, and it won't be possible.
He didn't answer. He looked at her, and it seemed he was drinking her in with his gaze.
I know what you're plotting, she hissed. Know what you want to do with me. And I'll tell you right now, I won't let you touch me. And if you... I'll kill you, even tied up. When you fall asleep, I'll tear your throat out with my teeth.
With a rapid gesture, the Imperator quietened the rumble gathering among the officers surrounding them.
What is destined shall be, he drawled, not taking his eyes off Ciri. Say goodbye to your friends, Cirilla, Fiona, Ellen, Rhiannon.
Ciri looked at the Witcher. Geralt shook his head. The girl sighed. She and Yennefer hugged and whispered for a long time. Then Ciri went closer to Geralt.
Pity, she said quietly. Things were looking more promising.
Much more.
They hugged each other.
Be brave.
He won't have me, she whispered. Don't worry. I'll escape from him. I have a way.
You may not kill him. Remember, Ciri? You may not.
Don't worry. I wasn't thinking about killing at all. You know, Geralt, I've had enough of killing. There's been too much of it.
Too much. Farewell, Witcher girl.
Farewell, Witcher.
Just don't cry.
Easier said than done.
Emiavar Emrys, Imperator of Nilfgaard, accompanied Yennefer and Geralt all the way to the bathroom, almost to the edge of a large marble pool full of steaming, fragrant water.
Farewell, he said. You don't have to hurry. I'm going, but I'm leaving people here who I shall instruct and to whom I shall issue orders. When you're ready, just call, and a lieutenant will give you a knife. But I repeat, you don't have to hurry.
We appreciate your favour.
Yennefer nodded gravely.
Your Imperial Majesty?
Yes.
Please, as far as possible, don't harm my daughter. I wouldn't want to die with the thought that she's crying.
Emir was silent for a long time. A very long time, leaning against a window with his head turned away. Madame Yennefer, he finally answered, and his face was very strange. You may be certain I shall not harm your and Witcher Geralt's daughter. I've trampled human bodies and danced on the barrows of my foes, and I thought I was capable of anything. But what you suspect me of, I simply wouldn't be capable of doing. I know it now. So I thank you both. Farewell. He went out, quietly closing the door behind him. Geralt sighed. Shall we undress? He glanced at the steaming pool. The thought that they'll haul me out of here as a naked corpse doesn't especially delight me.
And, can you believe it? To me it's all the same.
Yennefer threw off her slippers and unfastened her dress with swift movements.
Even if it's my last bath, I'm not going to bathe in my clothes.
She pulled her blouse over her head and entered the pool, energetically splashing water around.
Well, Geralt, why are you standing there like a statue?
I'd forgotten how beautiful you are.
You forget easily. Come on, into the water.
When he sat down beside her, she immediately threw her arms around his neck. He kissed her, stroking her waist above and below the water.
Is it, he asked for form's sake, an appropriate time?
Any time, she muttered, putting a hand under the water and touching him, is the right time for this. Emir repeated twice that we don't have to hurry. What would you prefer to spend doing during the last minutes given to you? Weeping and wailing? That's undignified, isn't it? Examining your conscience? That's banal and stupid, isn't it?
That's not what I meant.
So what did you mean?
The cuts will be painful if the water cools down, he murmured, caressing her breasts.
It's worth paying in pain.
Yennefer put her other hand in the water.
For pleasure. Are you afraid of pain?
No.
Neither am I. Sit on the edge of the pool. I love you, but I'm not bloody going to do it underwater. Oh my,
said Yennefer, tilting her head back so that her hair, damp from the steam, spread over the edge like little black vipers.
Oh my, oh.
I love you, Yen.
I love you, Geralt.
It's time. We'll call them.
We'll call them.
They called. First the Witcher called, and then Yennefer called. Then, not having heard any reaction, they yelled in unison.
Now! We're ready! Give us that knife! Hey! Damn it! The water's cooling down!
Get out of there! Said Ciri, peeping into the bathroom. They've all gone.
What?
I'm telling you, they've all gone. Apart from us three, there isn't a living soul here. Get dressed. You look awfully funny in the nude.
As they were dressing, their hands began to tremble, both Geralt's and Yennefer's. They had great difficulty coping with the hooks and eyes, clasps and buttons. Ciri was jabbering away.
They rode away, just like that. All of them. As many as there were of them. They took everyone from here, mounted the horses, and rode away as fast as they could.
Didn't they leave anybody?
Nobody at all.
That's staggering, whispered Geralt.
It's staggering. Has anything happened?
Yennefer cleared her throat.
To explain it?
No,
Ciri quickly replied. Nothing. She was lying. At first, she put on a brave front. Erect, with head haughtily raised and stony-faced, she pushed away the gloved hands of the black-cloaked knights, looking boldly and defiantly at the menacing nose-guards and visors of their helmets. They didn't touch her any longer, particularly since they were stopped from doing so by the growl of an officer, a broad-shouldered soldier with silver braid and a white heron-feather plume. She walked towards the exit, escorted on both sides, with her head proudly raised. Heavy boots thudded, mail shirts clanked and weapons jingled. After a dozen paces, she looked back for the first time. After the next few, the second time.
Why, I'll never ever see them again.
The thought flashed with terrifying and cool clarity beneath her crown.
Neither Geralt nor Yennefer. Never.
That awareness immediately, all at once, wiped away the mask of feigned courage. Ciri's face contorted and grimaced, her eyes filled with tears and her nose ran. The girl fought with all her strength, but in vain. A wave of tears breached the dam of pretense. The Nilfgaardians with salamanders on their cloaks looked at her in silence and amazement. Some of them had seen her on the bloody staircase. All of them had seen her in conversation with the Emperor. The Witcher girl with a sword, the unvanquished Witcher girl arrogantly challenging the Imperator to his face. And now they were surprised to see a sniveling, sobbing child. She was aware of it. Their eyes burned her like fire, pricked her like pins. She fought, but ineffectively. The more powerfully she held back her tears, the more powerfully they exploded. She slowed down and then stopped. The escort also stopped, but only for a moment. On the growling command of an officer, iron hands grasped her by the upper arms and wrists. Ciri, sobbing and swallowing back tears, looked back for the last time. Then they dragged her. She didn't resist, but sobbed louder and louder and more despairingly. They were stopped by Emperor Emir Vaemris, that dark-haired man with a face which awoke strange, vague memories in her. They released her when he gave a curt order. Ciri sniffed and wiped her eyes with her sleeve. Seeing him approaching, she stopped sobbing and raised her head haughtily. But now, she was aware of it, it just looked ridiculous. Emir looked at her for a long while, without a word. Then he approached her and held out a hand. Ciri, who always reacted to gestures like that by pulling away involuntarily, now, to her great amazement, didn't react. To her even greater amazement, she found his touch wasn't unpleasant at all. He touched her hair, as though counting the snow-white streaks. He touched her cheek, disfigured by the scar. Then he hugged her and stroked her head and back. And she, overwhelmed by weeping, let him, although she held her arms as stiffly as a scarecrow.
"It's a strange thing, destiny," she heard him whisper. "Farewell, my daughter."
What did he say?
Ciri's face grimaced slightly.
"He said, Varfael, Luned, in the Elder speech, farewell, girl. I know."
Yennefer nodded.
"What then?" Then he let me go. Turned around and walked away. He shouted some orders and everybody went. They passed me. Utterly, indifferently, with stamping, thudding, and the clanking of armour echoing down the corridor. They mounted their horses and rode away. I heard the neighing and tramping of hooves. I'll never understand that. For if I were to wonder...
Ciri.
What?
Don't wonder about it. Stigar Castle, repeated Philippa Eilhart, looking at Fringilla Vigo from under her eyelashes. Fringilla didn't blush. During the past 3 months, she had managed to manufacture a magical cream which made the blood vessels contract. Thanks to the cream, she didn't blush, no matter how embarrassed she was.
Vilgefortz's hideout was in Stigar Castle, confirmed Azirava Anahid. In Ebbing, above a mountain lake, whose name my informer, a simple soldier, was unable to recall.
You said, was,
Francesca Finderbeer observed.
Was, Philippa interrupted in mid-sentence, because Vilgefortz is dead, my dear ladies. He and his accomplices, the entire gang, are no more. That favour was done for us by no other than our good friend the Witcher, Geralt of Rivia, whom we didn't appreciate. None of us. About whom we were mistaken. All of us. Some of us, less seriously. Others more.
All the sorceresses looked at Fringilla in unison, but the cream really did act effectively. Azirava Anahid sighed. Philippa tapped her hand on the table.
Although the multitude of activities connected to the war and the preparations for the peace negotiations excuse us, she said dryly, we ought to admit that the fact of being thoroughly outmaneuvered, in the case of Vilgefortz, is a defeat for the Lodge. That must never happen to us again, my dear ladies.
The Lodge, with the exception of the ashen-pale Fringilla Vigo, nodded.
Right now, continued Philippa, the Witcher Geralt is somewhere in Ebbing, along with Yennefer and Ciri, whom he freed. We ought to ponder over how to find them.
And that castle? Sabrina Glevisig interrupted. Haven't you forgotten something, Philippa?
No, I haven't. The legend, if it should arise, ought to have a single faithful version. Thus, I'd like to ask you to do it, Sabrina. Take Kira and Triss with you. Sort out the matter, so that no trace remains.
The roar of the explosion was heard as far away as Mecht, and the flash, since it took place at night, was visible even in Matina and Jaso. The series of further tectonic shocks were perceptible even further away, at the remotest ends of the world. Congreve, Estella or Stella, the daughter of Baron Otto de Congreve, espoused to the Count of Liddetal, managed his estates extremely judiciously following his early death, owing to which she amassed a considerable fortune. Enjoying the great estimation of Emperor Emir Var Emrys, QV, she was a greatly important personage at his court. Although she held no position, it was known that the Emperor was always in the habit of gracing her voice and opinion with his attention and consideration. Owing to her great affection for the young Empress Cyrilla Fiona, see also, whom she loved like her own daughter, she was jokingly called the Empress Mother. Having survived both the Emperor and the Empress, she died in 1331, and her immense estate was left in her will to distant relatives, a side branch of the Liddetals called the White Liddetals. They, however, being careless and giddy-headed people, utterly squandered it. Effenberg and Talbot, Encyclopaedia Maxima Mundi, Volume 3. Chapter 10. The man stealing up to the camp, to give him his due, was as spry and cunning as a fox. He changed his position so swiftly and moved so agilely and quietly that he could have sneaked up on anyone. Anyone, but not Boreas Munn. Boreas Munn had too much experience in the matter of stalking.
"Come out, fellow," he called,
trying hard to colour his voice with self-assured and confident arrogance.
"Those tricks of yours are in vain. I see you. You're over there."
One of the megaliths, a ridge of which bristled on the hillside, twitched against the deep blue starry sky. It moved and assumed human form. Boreas turned some meat roasting on a spit, for he could smell burning. He laid his hand on his bow's riser, pretending to be leaning carelessly.
"My belongings are meagre."
He wove a gruff, metallic thread of warning into his apparently calm tone.
"There are a few of them, but I'm attached to them. I shall defend them to the death."
"I'm no bandit," said the man who had pretended to be a Menhir, in a deep voice. "I'm a pilgrim."
The pilgrim was tall and powerfully built, easily measuring 7 feet, and in order to balance him on a weighing scales, Boreas would have bet anything that a weight of at least 25 stone would have been required. His pilgrim's staff, a pole as thick as a cart shaft, looked like a walking cane in his hand. Boreas Munn was indeed amazed how such a huge clodhopper was able to steal up so agilely. He was also somewhat alarmed. His bow, a composite 70-pounder, with which he could down an elk at 4 dozen paces, suddenly seemed a small, fragile child's toy.
"I'm a pilgrim," repeated the powerful man. "I mean, any other man,"
Boreas interrupted sharply. "Let him come out too."
"What other," stammered the pilgrim,
and broke off, seeing a slender silhouette, noiseless as a shadow, emerging from the gloom on the other side. This time, Boreas Munn wasn't at all amazed. The other man, his way of moving immediately betrayed it to the tracker's trained eye, was an elf, and it is no disgrace to be sneaked upon by an elf.
"I ask for forgiveness," said the elf,
in a strangely unelven, slightly husky voice.
"I hid from both of you gentlemen, not from evil intentions, but from fear. I turned that spit over."
"Indeed," said the pilgrim, leaning on his staff and sniffing audibly. "The meat's cooked more than enough on that side."
Boreas turned the spit, sighed and cleared his throat, and sighed again.
"Sit ye down, gentlemen," he decided, "and wait. The animal will be done any minute. Verily, he's a fool who denies meat to travellers on the road."
The fat dribbled onto the fire with a hiss. The fire flared up. It became brighter. The pilgrim was wearing a felt hat with a broad brim, whose shadow quite effectively covered his face. A turban made from colourful cloth, not covering his face, served as headgear for the elf. When they saw his face in the glare of the campfire, both men, Boreas and the pilgrim, shuddered, but didn't utter so much as a gasp, not even a soft one, at the sight of the face, once, no doubt, elfinly beautiful, now disfigured by a hideous scar running diagonally across his forehead, brow, nose and cheek to his chin. Boreas Munn cleared his throat and turned the spit again.
"This sweet fragrance lured you to my campfire," he stated rather than asked. "Didn't it, gentlemen?"
"Indeed."
The pilgrim tipped the brim of his hat, and his voice changed a little.
"I smelled out the roots from far away with all due modesty, but I remained cautious. They were roasting a woman on a campfire I approached 2 days ago.
"That's true," confirmed the elf. "I was there the next morning. I saw human bones in the ashes."
"The next morning?"
the pilgrim repeated in a slow, drawling voice, and Boreas would have bet anything that a nasty smile had appeared on the face concealed by the shadow of the hat.
"Have you been tracking me in secret for so long, Master Elf?"
"Aye."
"And what stopped you revealing yourself?"
"Good sense."
"The Euskadoic Pass."
Boreas Munn turned the spit and interrupted the awkward silence.
"Is a place that doesn't enjoy the best of reputations. I've also seen bones on campfires, skeletons on stakes, men hanging from trees. This place is full of the savage followers of cruel cults and creatures just waiting to eat you, according to hearsay."
"It's not hearsay,"
the elf corrected him.
"It's the truth, and the further into the mountains towards the east, the worse it'll be."
"Are you gentlemen also travelling eastwards, beyond Elskadeg, to Zerikania, or perhaps even further to Hackland?"
Neither the pilgrim nor the elf replied. Boreas hadn't really expected an answer. Firstly, the question had been indiscreet. Secondly, it had been stupid. From where they were, it was only possible to go back, or eastwards, through Elskadeg, where he too was headed.
"Roast's ready."
Boreas opened a butterfly knife with a deft flourish meant to impress.
"Go ahead, gentlemen, help yourselves."
The pilgrim had a cutlass, and the elf a dagger, which also didn't resemble a kitchen knife at all. But all 3 blades, sharpened for more menacing purposes, served to carve meat that day. For some time, all that could be heard was crunching and munching, and the sizzling of chewed bones thrown into the embers. The pilgrim belched in a dignified manner.
"Strange little creature," he said, examining the shoulder blade, which he had gnawed clean and licked until it looked as though it had been kept for 3 days in an anthill. "It tasted a bit like goat, and it was as tender as Cody. I don't recall eating anything like that."
"It was a skrek," said the elf, crunching the gristle with a crack. "Neither do I recall eating it at any time."
Boreas cleared his throat quietly. The barely audible note of sarcastic merriment in the elf's voice proved he knew that the roast came from an enormous rat with bloodshot eyes and huge teeth, only the tail of which measured 3 ells. The tracker had by no means hunted the gigantic rodent. He had shot it in self-defense, but had decided to roast it. He was a sensible and clear-headed man. He wouldn't have eaten a rat scavenging on rubbish heaps and eating scraps, but it was a good 300 miles from the narrow passage of the Elskaderg Pass to the nearest community capable of generating waste. The rat, or as the elf had said, skrek, must have been clean and healthy. It hadn't had any contact with civilization, so there was nothing it could have been soiled by or infected with. Soon, the last, smallest bone, chewed and sucked clean, landed in the embers. The moon rose over the jagged range of the fiery mountains. The wind fed the fire and sparks shot up, dying out and fading amidst the countless twinkling stars.
"Long on a row, gentlemen?"
Boreas Munn risked another none too discreet question.
"Here, in the wildernesses. Left the Solviga gate behind you long since, if you'll pardon my asking." "Long since? Long since," said the pilgrim, "is a relative thing. I passed through Solviga Gate the second day after the September full moon."
"Me on the 6th day, said the elf.
"Huh," continued Boreas Munn, encouraged by the reaction. "It's a wonder we've only met up now, because I also walked that way, or actually rode, for I still had a horse then."
He fell silent, driving away the unpleasant thoughts and recollections linked to the horse and its loss. He was sure his accidental companions must also have had similar adventures. If they'd been walking the whole time, they never would have caught up with him here, near Elskaderg.
"I venture thus," he continued, "that you set off right after the war, after the Peace of Sintra was concluded, gentlemen. It's none of my business, naturally, but I dare suppose that you were not pleased by the order and vision of the world created and established in Sintra."
The lengthy silence that fell by the campfire was interrupted by distant howling. A wolf, probably, although in the vicinity of the Elskaderg Pass you could never be certain.
"If I'm to be frank," the elf spoke up unexpectedly, "I didn't have the grounds to be pleased with the world and its image following the Peace of Sintra, not to mention the New Order."
"In my case it was similar," said the pilgrim, crossing his powerful forearms on his chest, "though I came to realize it, as a friend said, post factum."
Silence reigned for a long time. Even whatever had been howling on the pass was silent.
"At first," continued the pilgrim, although Boreas and the elf had been ready to bet he would not, "at first, everything indicated that the Peace of Sintra would bring favorable changes, would create quite a tolerable world order, if not for everyone, then at least for me."
"If my memory serves me," Boreas cleared his throat, "the kings arrived in Sintra in April?"
"The 2nd of April, to be precise," the pilgrim corrected him. "It was, I recall, a full moon."
Along the walls, positioned below the dark beams supporting a small gallery, hung rows of shields with colourful representations of the heraldic emblems and coats of arms of the Sintran nobility. A first glance revealed the differences between the now somewhat faded arms of the ancient families and those of families ennobled more recently during the reigns of Dagorad and Calanthe. The newer ones had vivid and not yet cracked paint, and no peppering of woodworm holes was visible on them, whereas the escutcheons of the more recently ennobled Nilfgaardian families, rewarded during the capture of the castle and the 5-year imperial administration, had the most vivid colours.
"When we regain Sintra," thought King Foltest, "it will be necessary to make sure the Sintrans don't destroy those shields in a fervour of revival.
Politics is one thing, the hall's decor another. Changes in regimes cannot be a justification for vandalism.
So, everything began here, thought Dykstra, looking around the great hall. The celebrated betrothal banquet, during which the steel Urchian appeared and demanded the hand of Princess Favetta, and Queen Calanthe engaged the witcher. How bizarre are the twists of human fate, thought the spy, surprising himself at the banality of his own musings.
5 years ago, thought Queen Maeve, 5 years ago, the brain of Calanthe, the lioness of the blood of the Serbians, splashed onto the floor of the courtyard. This very courtyard I can see from the windows. Calanthe, whose proud portrait we saw in the corridor, was the penultimate living carrier of the royal blood. After her daughter, Pavetta, drowned, the only one left was her granddaughter, Cyrilla. Unless the news that Cyrilla is also dead is true.
Please!
Cyrus Engelkind Hemelfart, the hierarch of Novigrad, accepted on grounds of age, position, and universal respect, per acclamationem, as the chairman of the meeting, beckoned with a trembling hand.
Please, take your seats.
They found their chairs, which were marked by mahogany plaques, and sat down at the round table. Maeve, Queen of Rivia and Lyria, Foltest, King of Temeria, and his vassal, King Ventslav of Brugge, Demavend, King of Adian, Henselt, King of Caedwen, King Ithin of Sidaris, young King Kistrin of Verden, Duke Neithert, head of the Redanian Regency Council, and Count Dykstra.
We must rid ourselves of that spy. Remove him from the conference table, thought the hierarch. King Henselt and King Foltest, why, even young Kistrin, have taken the liberty of making sour remarks, so at any moment there'll be a démarche from the Nilfgaardian representatives. Sigismund Dykstra is a man of unseemly breeding, and furthermore a person with a dirty past and bad reputation, a persona turpis. One cannot let the presence of a persona turpis infect the atmosphere of the negotiation.
The head of the Nilfgaardian delegation, Baron Shillard Fitzostelin, who had been allotted a place at the round table immediately opposite Dykstra, greeted the spy with a polite diplomatic bow. Seeing that everybody was now seated, the hierarch of Novigrad also sat down, not without the help of pages supporting him by his trembling arms. The hierarch sat down on a chair made for Queen Calanthe many years before. The chair had an impressively high and richly decorated backrest, making it stand out among the other ones.
So it was here, thought Triss Merigold,
looking around the chamber, staring at the tapestries, paintings and numerous hunting trophies, and the antlers of a horned animal totally unfamiliar to her.
It was here, after the infamous shambles in the throne room, where the famous private conversation between Calanthe, the Witcher, Pavetta, and the enchanted Urchian occurred. When Calanthe gave her agreement to that bizarre marriage, and Pavetta was already pregnant. Ciri was born almost 8 months later. Ciri, the heir to the throne. The lion cub from the lioness's blood. Ciri, my little sister, who's still somewhere far away in the south. Fortunately, she's no longer alone. She's with Geralt and Yennefer. She's safe. Unless they've lied to me again.
Sit down, dear ladies, urged Philippa Eilhart, who had been scrutinising Triss closely for some time.
In a short while, the rulers of the world will begin making their inaugural speeches, one after another. I wouldn't want to miss a word.
The sorceresses, interrupting their furtive gossiping, quickly took their seats. Shayla de Tankerville, in a boa of silver fox, which gave a feminine accent to her severe male outfit. Azirivar Anahid, in a dress of mauve silk, which extremely gracefully combined modest simplicity with chic elegance. Francesca Finderbear, regal as usual. Ida Emain Epsivni, mysterious as usual. Margarita Lozantile, distinguished and serious. Sabrina Glevesig in turquoise. Kira Metz in green and daffodil yellow. And Fringilla Vigo, dejected, sad, and pale with a truly deathly, morbid, utterly ghastly paleness. Triss Merigold was sitting beside Kira, opposite Fringilla. A painting depicting a horseman galloping headlong down a road between an avenue of alders hung above the head of the Nilfgaardian sorceress. The alders were holding out their monstrous arm-like boughs towards the rider, sneeringly smiling with the ghastly maws of their hollows. Triss shuddered involuntarily. The three-dimensional telecommunicator standing in the middle of the table was active. Philippa Eilhart used a spell to focus the image and sound.
"Ladies, as you can see and hear," she said, not without a sneer, "the rulers of the world are, at this very moment, getting down to deciding the fate of it in the throne room of Sintra, plumb beneath us, one floor lower. And we, here, one floor above them, will be watching over, so that the boys don't go too wild."
Other howlers joined the howler howling in Elskadeg. Boreas had no doubt. They weren't wolves.
"I hadn't expected much from those Sintran talks either," he said, in order to revive the dead conversation. "Why, no one I know expected any good to come of them."
"The simple fact that the negotiations began was important," calmly protested the pilgrim. "A simple fellow, and I indeed am just such a fellow, if I may say so, thinks simply. A simple fellow knows that the warring kings and emperors aren't that furious with each other. If they could have, if they'd had the strength, they'd have killed each other. That they've stopped trying to kill each other, and instead have sat down to a round table, that means they have no more power. They are, to put it simply, powerless. And the result of that powerlessness is that no armed men are attacking a simple fellow's homestead. They aren't killing, aren't mutilating, aren't burning down buildings. They aren't cutting children's throats, aren't raping wives or driving people into captivity. No. Instead of that, they've gathered in Sintra and are negotiating. Let's rejoice."
The elf finished poking with his stick a log in the fire that was shooting sparks and looked askance at the pilgrim.
"Even a simple fellow," he said, not concealing the sarcasm. "Even if he's joyful, why, even euphoric, or to understand that politics is also a war, just conducted a little differently. He ought to understand that negotiations are like trade. They have the same self-propelling mechanism. Negotiated successes are bought with concessions. You win some, you lose some. In other words, in order for some people to be bought, others have to be sold."
"Indeed," the pilgrim said after a while. "It's so simple and obvious that every man understands it. Even a simple one."
"No, no, and once more, no!" yelled King Henselt,
banging both fists on the table so hard he knocked over a goblet and made the inkwells jump.
"No discussions on that subject. No horse trading in this matter. That's the end of it. That's the Dirath."
"Henselt," Foltest spoke calmly, soberly, and very placatingly, "don't make things difficult, and don't embarrass us in front of His Excellency with your yelling." Shelard Fitz-Ostelin, negotiator for the Empire of Nilfgaard, bowed with a false smile, which was meant to imply that the King of Caedwin's antics were neither shocking nor bothering him. "We are negotiating with the Empire," continued Foltest, "and amongst ourselves we've suddenly begun to bite each other like dogs. It's a disgrace, Henselt."
"We've reached agreement with Nilfgaard in matters as difficult as Dol Angra and Rivendell," said Dykstra, apparently casually.
"It would be stupid." "I won't have such remarks," roared Henselt,
this time so loudly that not even a buffalo would have matched him.
"I won't put up with such remarks, particularly from spies of all people. I'm the king, for fuck's sake."
"That's quite plain," snorted Maeve.
Demavend, his back to them, was looking at the escutcheons on the wall, smiling contemptuously, quite as if the game was not about his kingdom.
"Enough," panted Henselt, eyes roving around. "Enough! Enough, by the gods! Oh, my blood will boil. I said, not a span of land. No but no repossession. I won't agree to my kingdom being reduced by so much as a span, even half a span of land. The gods entrusted me with the honor of Caedwin, and only to the gods will I give it up. The Lower Marches is our land, our ethnic land. The Lower Marches have belonged to Caedwin for centuries.
Upper Edion, Dykstra spoke again, has belonged to Caedwin since last year. To be precise, since the 24th of July last year, from the moment a Caedwinian occupying force invaded it.
I request, Shilod Fitz-Osterlin said without being asked, for it to be minuted, ad futurum re memoriam, that the Empire of Nilfgaard had nothing to do with that annexation.
Apart from the fact that it was pillaging Vengerberg at the time.
Nihil ad rem.
Indeed.
A gentleman, Faltist admonished.
The Caedwinian army, Ralph Tenselt, entered the Lower Marches as liberators. My soldiers were welcomed there with flowers. My soldiers.
Your bandits. King Demoven's voice was calm, but it was apparent from his face how much effort it was costing him. Your brigands, who invaded my kingdom with a murderous hussar, murdered, raped, and looted. Gentlemen, we have gathered here and have been debating for a week. We're debating about what the future face of the world should be. By the gods, is it to be a face of crime and pillage? Is the murderous status quo to be maintained? Are plundered goods to remain in the hands of the thug and the marauder? Henselt seized a map from the table, tore it up with a violent movement, and hurled it towards Demavend. The King of Adian didn't even move.
My army,
wheezed Henselt, and his face took on the colour of good old wine.
Captured the marches from the Nilfgaardians. Your woof or kingdom didn't even exist then, Demavend. I shall say more. Had it not been for my army, you wouldn't even have a kingdom today. I'd like to see you driving the black cloaks over the Yoruga and beyond Dol Angra without my help. Thus the statement that your king, by my grace, wouldn't be much of an exaggeration. But here my generosity ends. I said I won't give up even a span of my land. I won't let my kingdom be diminished.
Nor I. Demavend stood up. We shall not reach agreement then.
Gentlemen.
Cyrus Hemelfart, the hierarch of Novigrad, who had been slumbering until then, suddenly spoke in a placatory manner.
Some kind of compromise is surely possible.
The Empire of Nilfgaard, began again Shilod Fitz-Osterlin, who liked to butt in out of the blue, will not accept any deal that would be damaging to the land of elves in Dol Blathanna. If necessary, I shall read you once again the contents of the memorandum. Henselt, Foltest, and Dykstra snorted, but Demavend looked at the imperial ambassador calmly and almost benignly. For the general good and for peace, he declared, I recognize the autonomy of Dol Blathanna, not as a kingdom, but as a duchy. The condition is that Duchess Enid Angleana pays liege homage to me and obligates herself to grant equal rights and privileges to humans and elves. I'm prepared to do that, as I have said, pro publico bono.
Spoken like a true king, said Maeve.
Salus publica lex suprema est, said Hierarch Hemelfart,
who had also been searching for some time for the chance to show off his knowledge of diplomatic jargon.
I shall add, nonetheless, continued Demavend, looking at the pompous Henselt, that the concession regarding Dol Blathanna is not a precedent. It is the only encroachment on the integrity of my lands to which I shall agree. I shall not recognize any other partition. The Caedwinian army that invaded my borders as an aggressor and invader has 1 week to abandon the illegally occupied fortalices and castles of Upper Adian. That is the condition of my further participation in this conference, and because, verba volant, my secretary shall submit to the minutes an official démarche in the case.
Henselt?
Foltest looked hesitantly at the bearded king.
Never!
Roared the King of Caedwin, knocking over a chair and hopping like a chimpanzee stung by a hornet.
I'll never give up the marches, over my dead body, never! Nothing will make me. No force. No fucking force.
and in order to prove he was also well-born and educated, he howled, "Non possumus!"
"I'll give him non possumus, the old fool,"
snorted Sabrina Glevisig in the upstairs chamber.
"You need not worry, ladies. I'll force that blockhead to recognize the repossession demands in the case of Upradian. The Kaidwanian army will leave before 10 days are up. The matter is clear. No two ways about it. If any of you doubted it, I have the right to feel piqued indeed."
Philippa Eilhart and Sherla de Tankerville expressed their acknowledgement by bowing. Izirava Anahid gave her thanks with a smile.
"All that remains today," said Sabrina, "is to settle the matter of Dolblatana. We know the contents of Emperor Anir's memorandum. The kings down below still haven't had the chance to discuss that matter, but have signalled their preferences, and the most, I would say, interested party has taken a stance. That's King Demavend."
"Demavend's stance," said Sherla de Tankerville,
wrapping the silver foxbow around her neck,
"bears the features of a far-reaching compromise. It's a positive, considered and balanced stance. Shillard Fitz-Ostelin will have considerable difficulty trying to argue in the direction of greater concessions. I don't know if he'll want to."
"He will," Azireva Anahid stated calmly, "because those are the instructions he has from Nilfgaard. He will invoke ad referendum and submit notes. He'll argue for at least a day. After that time has passed, he'll begin to make concessions."
"That's normal," Sabrina Glevisig cut her off. "It's normal that they'll finally find some common ground and agree on something. We won't wait for that. We'll decide right away what they'll ultimately be permitted to do. Francesca, say something. It's about your country, after all."
"Just for that reason,"
the Daisy of the Valley smiled very beautifully,
"just for that reason, I'm keeping quiet, Sabrina."
"Get over your pride," Margarita Lozantila said gravely. "We have to know what we can allow the kings." Francesca Finderbear smiled even more beautifully.
"For the sake of peace and pro bono publico," she said, "I agree to King Demavend's offer. From this moment, you may stop addressing me as your Royal Highness, my dear girls. An ordinary, your enlightenment will suffice."
"Elven jokes," Sabrina grimaced, "don't amuse me at all, probably because I don't understand them. What about Demavend's other conditions?" Francesca fluttered her eyelashes.
"I agree to the re-immigration of human settlers and the return of their estates," she said gravely. "I guarantee equality to all races. For the love of the gods, Enid," laughed Philippa Eilhart, "don't agree to everything. Set some conditions." "I shall."
The elf suddenly grew more serious.
"I don't agree to liege homage. I want Dolblatana as a freehold. No vassal duties, apart from an oath of loyalty, and no actions to the detriment of the suzerain."
"Demavend won't agree," Philippa commented curtly. "He won't waive the income and rent that the Valley of Flowers gave him."
"In that matter,"
Francesca raised her eyebrows,
"I'm prepared to negotiate bilaterally. I'm sure we can achieve consensus. The freehold doesn't demand payment, but it doesn't forbid nor exclude it either."
"And what about familial inheritance?"
Philippa Eilhart kept digging.
"What about primogeniture? By agreeing to a freehold, Foltest will want a guarantee of the duchy's indivisibility."
"My complexion and figure may indeed beguile Foltest,"
Francesca smiled again.
"But I'm surprised at you, Philippa. The age when falling pregnant was a possibility is far, far behind me. Regarding primogeniture and fideicommissum, Demavend ought not to be afraid, for I shall be the ultimus famili of the dynasty of Dolblatana's monarchs. But in spite of the age difference Demavend sees as advantageous, we will be resolving the issue of inheritance not with him, but rather his grandchildren. I assure you, ladies, there will be no moot points in this matter."
"Not in this one,"
agreed Azirava Anahid, looking into the sorceress's elven eyes.
"And what about the matter of the Squirrel Commando units? What about the elves who fought for the Empire? If I'm not mistaken, this mainly concerns your subjects, Madame Francesca."
The Daisy of the Valleys stopped smiling. She glanced at Ida Emaean,